Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have on the political right, Senator Dan McKay.
Hey, Natalie. Hey, everybody.
And on the political left, Shireen Gourbani. Hi, Shireen.
Hello, and hey to the listeners. Thanks for tuning in.
Shireen and Dan, I'm just thinking about all the news out there. I mean, we got a heat wave in the Pacific Northwest. What, Portland hits 116 degrees. We had Derek Chauvin sentenced. And we have the Biden airstrikes. But what really caught my attention is the notion that we are really seeing two Americas emerge, an America that's vaccinated and an America that's not vaccinated. And Shireen, you mentioned the stats that our governor shared that since March 23rd, when, you know, basically adults could be vaccinated in Utah, all adults, we've had, what, 116 deaths? And was it 98% of them are people that have not been vaccinated?
Not been vaccinated. Similarly, we're seeing an uptick in our cases in general, likely driven by the Delta variant. And what we know is that of the, I believe it's 22,000 cases, there are, again, similar stats, over 98% of those individuals who are contracting COVID are unvaccinated. And this is really going to be, I mean, a challenge, could be a challenge for our healthcare system again. And when we're thinking about just the way that this disparity plays out across even counties regionally, I saw today that Washington County is at 31% vaccinated. We've got, you know, Daggett and Summit, I believe, are our only two counties that are in the 60%. We're at about halfway, and we may lose, unnecessarily, a number of more Utahns. And I just really don't, I'm frustrated and I'm worried about that.
Yeah. Dan, it seems like there's, you know, obviously a state interest here, and that up on Capitol Hill, this notion that you've got 62% in one county vaccinated, 31% in another, that's two Utahs emerging. And we talk a lot about how the United States is more favorably positioned than other countries, but we have some of the same divides occurring in our own state.
Well, and I think, you know, you also have a certain component of COVID and the coronavirus is rolling to the back of people's minds. It's not on the forefront, right? Even the press conferences, the numbers, I can honestly tell you, most people cannot tell you what yesterday's was. They can't tell you what the rolling average was, but 6 months ago they could, right? And those kinds of questions were right at the front of everybody's mind. So yeah, things are changing, but people need to, you know, maintain the intelligent practices that we learned during the shutdown and even afterwards, trying to continue to maintain a safe thing. The part I think that's really hard for some people is knowing that the coronavirus itself is not ever actually like going away, right? It's the new flu potentially. Like, we're going to be having variants, we're going to be having boosters, we're going to be dealing with this in an ongoing way. I don't know that there's a great answer to it, but I think that you will see another change as far as the mentality of the vaccine, because I hear it from a lot of people that once, like, the FDA actually takes it off of like emergency approval and makes it actually approved, I do think that will change the mentality of a lot of people as well.
Mm-hmm. I hope it does. I just don't know that I can trust that. And I just want to also put in a plug. I think people sometimes still don't know. This is a vaccine that people can access without cost. And this is a vaccine that is available to everyone regardless of their immigration status. Your immigration status, your ability to pay will not be a barrier to you getting the vaccine in this state.
Mm-hmm. Dan, we had other news in Washington that is interesting. It was basically the Senate or some Senate leaders and President Biden agreeing on an infrastructure bill. It did exclude the provisions that dealt with climate and the jobs program. But it was kind of interesting the way it played out. Biden was a bit flip floppy on this one. He came out in support, and then he saw that his political base was upset. And so he flipped, and then he saw that Republicans in the Senate were upset. And it seemed to me like he flipped again. I would not want to be staffing that White House right now.
Yeah, I was surprised, between you and me, with the aggressive nature that, like, literally as the press conference ends, the aggressive nature of calling for reconciliation. And so for our listeners who really don't pay attention to DC or the process, let me just bore you for 1 second. A bill is passed in the House and a bill is passed in the Senate. They are never the same bill. Okay. And so then what they do is they come up with rules, which, by the way, most people don't know this either, that Washington, D.C., the Congress actually makes up their own rules for every single freaking bill. Okay. And so they decide what can be discussed in reconciliation, and a committee gets together, and generally it's leadership and some stakeholders, and they come up with a merging of the decks, so to speak, and they walk away with a bill that both sides can then pass. That's the reconciliation effort. But going from a $1.6 trillion bill and saying he won't sign it unless it has a $6 trillion spending package, what that tells me is the president may not necessarily, A, either doesn't fully comprehend the what's going on, which I don't believe that that's the case. What I would say is he is being whipsawed, which is what you alluded a second ago. He is just being whipsawed by his base. And I don't know that there's a path forward actually on the bill.
Yeah. Shereen, why do you think it is that when it's really a bipartisan Congress right now, I mean, neither has a very big majority anywhere, and you really do have to work together to get things done. Why do you think that, let's say, the progressive left feels so emboldened to stand in the way of a bipartisan infrastructure bill that this country needs?
So it's an interesting way of framing it. I would say there are a couple of things that are occurring to me kind of watching this from my perspective. It seemed like the argument all along from the Biden administration was that there were multiple pieces of these priorities, including childcare infrastructure, thinking about, healthcare as part of this, thinking about climate as part of this. That was part of the agenda from the beginning, and then suggested that it would be able, maybe that it would happen through a different process. I kind of feel like in some ways this really has been political theater to say, okay, we're going to have this bipartisan infrastructure bill. People can feel like they got a win. But ultimately, the message from the White House was that this was going to move forward potentially through some other process. So I think that's one thing. I think another thing we need to consider is that in our Senate, while we do have it's 50-50, those 50 Democratic senators, those Democrats represent millions of more Americans than are represented by our Republicans. And that is simply math. And so when we're thinking about things like the broader agreement in this country, and frankly, we're seeing this from Republicans, that climate change is a central issue as we are moving forward. It is fundamental to what's happening in our economy, our national security. It's tied to many elements of what we're seeing in terms of extreme heat and cold right now. People in this country agree that something needs to happen on climate change. So I wish that we could maybe have at least seen climate more centered in this infrastructure bill, given what we've been seeing happening, over the last decades. And frankly, the reports that we're seeing now that are suggesting that we have to do something. We absolutely have to do something. Mm-hmm. And it can mean good jobs in this country. It can mean programs and initiatives that we're proud of. And I'd like to see that move forward.
You know, from the political middle, I'm a big proponent of starting where we have agreement and then moving along. And if we did more of that, we would solve more problems in this country. I think this is a little off topic, but you look at, let's say, Bureau of Land Management wilderness in our state, and there's areas of our state that everybody agree must be protected as wilderness. Let's get it done. But what happens is they hold out so that they have leverage to bring them in for other things where there's not as much agreement. And I think it doesn't serve the public well. Another international news story I want to get your comments on, Dan. The U.S. military is just days away from withdrawing the majority of its troops from Afghanistan. This is ahead of schedule. They'll probably just leave in enough troops to secure the U.S. embassy and the airport there. But this is, this is going to result in a large, I think, civil war. And I just want to get your comments from the right on what we see happening there.
Well, you can't. Okay, this just goes to my governing philosophy. You can't show up with guns and change the hearts of people. Okay, and I think the American military, if we don't do something, we will literally have Afghanistan as a protectorate for a long, long time. There may be war. There may be some of these things internally. There's a question as to, we need to make sure from a humanitarian standpoint that we, are keeping an eye on the humanitarian nature of it. But there's also a struggle that, we saw this back in the late 1700s, right? That breeds a identity and a nation and brings people together. And hopefully, that kind of thing isn't necessary and they're able to really lead themselves in a productive and meaningful way. But Afghanistan, for those who don't know the history of that region, the Ottoman Empire, everything else, it has been an area in conflict for hundreds of years.
Yeah. Shireen, your quick comment on this military withdrawal.
Yeah, I think this is a troubling and destabilizing time. We're seeing, the Taliban certainly making surge and efforts to control areas. I believe a report came out this week that said they thought that it would only be about 6 months of stability before, a potential collapse of the government. That's alarming. And to think about what happens after, I agree. We can't stay in perpetual war. I don't want to stay in perpetual war. I think this war was a mistake from the beginning. But here we are. And I think it's going to be a disaster.
Yeah, it's interesting. Nation building is much more difficult than war, for sure. We lost Donald Rumsfeld, I believe he was 88 years old. I just, as we close out this segment, will just mention, this is someone I got to meet during the 2002 Olympic Winter Games. He visited our state. He was such an amazing and interesting man. He's the guy that said there are known knowns, there are known unknowns, and there are also unknown unknowns. What a guy. Dan, quick comments on Secretary Rumsfeld, who made such an imprint, basically is the architect of what the administration during the Bush years.
Yeah. And you knew him during the Bush years, and he also served under President Gerald Ford. And so this is a man who has a storied career and legacy in Washington. And, I think that Donald Rumsfeld, when the history looks back on his time, that he'll be viewed favorably, and that, kind of like George W. Bush and his administration is now growing in favor with a lot of people and seeing how successful he was in leading the country during that time period. So it's always sad to lose a big pillar of history like Donald Rumsfeld, but heart goes out to his family.
Quick comment, Shireen.
Well, my read on Rumsfeld's legacy would certainly be different. It is completely inappropriate to speak ill of the dead, but I'll just say when I think about Rumsfeld, I'm certainly recalling a deeply troubled approach to the war in Iraq, the torture of prisoners at Guantanamo Bay, many human rights violations that are that were a big imprint on me as a person in college when a lot of that was happening. Like I said, it's not polite to speak ill of the dead.
But I asked. Hey, thanks for sharing, Shireen from the left, Dan from the right. In our next segment, we've got some great news. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shireen Gourbani on the left.
Dan McKay on the right.
Natalie Gawkner in the Political Center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. Before we jump into local news, Shireen, I just want to get your quick comment on the Florida Tower collapse in Miami. Good heavens, that is a tragedy, and it's only going to get worse before it gets better.
Oh, this is a terrible story, and just a heartache for this community, certainly. I've been following the news, listening to the stories of the first responders, people who are dealing with incredibly difficult conditions. It sounds like this building simply pancaked. And so there really is not, it's a dangerous site to be excavating and looking for individuals. And I just have to say there are a few things. I think one, it seemed like there had been many reports suggesting that there were problems structurally with this building. There had been a lot of back and forth about, the impact of corrosion from seawater on core structural elements of this building, and that there simply just wasn't the kind of response that was probably needed to protect these individuals, obviously, now. So it's a terrible tragedy, and my heart's really with that community.
Dan, how do you think it'll change things moving forward in the Miami Beach area?
Well, unfortunately, a tragedy sometimes breeds a lot of, self-review. And I think there'll be a lot of, I'm just aware of some of these buildings in Florida, and I'm aware of some of the issues that come along with living in the coast, in a coastal area. And, eventually we're going to find the cause. And whatever the cause is, I'm hopeful that we will be focused from a building code perspective on, repairing the actual cause of what it is. But clearly, living in a high-rise condo inspections need to take place, and you need to make sure that, from an HOA standpoint or whatever it might be, that you're just watching the building. But man, I'm really interested to find out what the cause was when they say this is what it was. Some of the rumors are that it was a chain of a couple of things that if they'd happened individually, not a problem. But when you combine them, it caused disaster.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's what I would guess. I want to talk about Mayor Mendenhall announcing these big pay bumps for Salt Lake City Police Department, 30% for entry-level officers, 12% for senior-level officers. She noted that these pay raises were supported by the Commission on Racial Equity in Policing. You know, Dan and Shereen, I had an event this week where my husband and I got a call about 4 a.m. You never like to get those calls. Pick up the phone. Of course, it's the alarm service at my husband's business. Motion detector in the main area. We ended up having an intruder, someone that busted into the shop and did some damage. Didn't take much. We got there quickly. The alarm system worked. But I bring it up because I watched as three Murray City police officers entered that building, not knowing if someone was in there, not knowing what was in there, and secured our little business. And I said to my husband, we're just kind of out in the car watching this, and I just said, I am so glad you're not a police officer. So, you know, on the face of it, I trust Mayor Mendenhall and her team to know what's right. But Shereen, let's go to you first, just to comment on what Mayor Mendenhall did there with that raise in a time of defund police kind of movements.
Yeah, so a couple things come to mind for me. One thing that I think it's difficult to talk about in the context of how we think about policing or the future of policing. You know, you mentioned individuals going into a building in the middle of the night. I think a lot about community response to intimate partner violence, which is actually one of the most dangerous things that we ask police officers to do in our community. It's a place where we've unfortunately lost a number of police officers in this community responding to domestic violence calls. When I think about the way that we've used police to do just about everything, because we have systematically defunded other support systems across our society. What I know is that when it comes to police, we get what we pay for. And so when we want people who maybe can come into that line of work with a higher level of education or who have spent time developing skills in other, you know, facets of our society, people who are bringing with them a high level of skill sets, high emotional intelligence, high quality candidates, that's going to cost communities more. But I think we also need to be thinking about what is it that we're really asking police to do? And is it the right thing that we're asking them to do? Are there other ways that we could be spending more money upstream to prevent police from having to interact in some of the most dangerous situations we've created over and over again in our society?
Dan, did you see enough coming out of Mayor Mendenhall on this to get a feel for the issue and whether it was the right decision on her part?
Well, the decision seems to be in line with a lot of measures, right? Our law enforcement communities, a lot of our public servants in a lot of capacities throughout the state are, you know, going to need to see pay bumps just with inflation that's constantly coming on, right? And so when you see, you know, numbers month over month, inflation numbers around 10%, you know there's going to be a need for inflationary measures. And I'll just say that I loved the article in it, because I have a longstanding joke and feud with Mayor Mendenhall, who I affectionately call Photo Shoot Mendenhall, because the press always treats her so well. And so, you know, if I could get half of the great photos that Mayor Mendenhall gets to take and put them in an article, I'd love it. But anyways, I'm grateful to see this support for law enforcement in Salt Lake City.
Yeah. You know,
I wish that we were seeing the same kind of supports when it comes to things like investing in their retirement, education. And those are some things that we could see moved forward from the legislature in more meaningful ways. And it would be important to see that, too.
I'll just say from the political middle, one instinct I had is when the police were entering our little building to look, you know, if the intruder was still there. I was inside hoping the intruder wasn't there because I didn't want anything bad to happen. And I know the police were hoping the intruder was there because they like to catch people and do their job. Kind of interesting. Dan, Dixie State is now, the new name, which was going to be what, Utah Polytechnic State University, is officially dead. The Board of Trustees voted unanimously Tuesday in St. George to recommend the name Utah Tech University to the Utah Board of Higher Education. Two comments. One, why don't we think about naming it something that is consistent with the region? You know, instead of calling it a tech, I don't know. I just found that it didn't differentiate it. And then the second, why aren't they thinking about having University of Utah St. George? I, in a minute, would take the Block U brand and merge with the flagship university. I know I've not heard anyone talking about that, but I think that would be a terrific move.
So you'd have to go back to when we originally made Dixie State a university. We elevated its status from a college to a university. I made this same argument. Now, I did think that, you know, Utah State as a land-grant school already has a presence down in St. George. And I thought, you know, hey, St. George, you know, extension of Utah State,
yeah,
something
I'd be fine
in
with that,
or even University of Utah, I'd be great. I don't know. I don't love the tech is okay. The problem I have is they have a regional name now that nobody likes. And so, the, you know, but what you can know in higher ed, and Natalie will probably, you know, wrinkle her nose a little bit at this. What you do know in higher ed is they are always going for safe. They're always going for predictable. Don't rock the boat. And there are techs all over the country. And so there is no risk in calling it tech.
Yeah. Shireen, what are your thoughts on what they ought to name this? You know, it's an incredible metropolitan area and it has a huge upside. What are you thinking on that?
I'm here for University of Utah St. George.
That a girl.
Great idea.
Good.
Go Utes.
You know, do you think, and this is, you know, goes to the risk component, but St. George does have almost a religious sounding tone to it for national presence, right? And that's one of the issues they're having is that national
presence. University of Utah Southwest. I think that'd be terrific.
Why not?
Hey,
yeah.
Were you surprised at all, Shireen, to see that Representative Burgess Owens got fined by the Federal Election Commission for failing to timely report some of his contributions in the 2020 campaign?
Not surprised. I will say, as a person who has navigated those reporting structures and that system, you would need to hire the right people to do that kind of work. It is not easy to do that kind of stuff. But when you have a race like that race, as close as it was, coming down to what, about 3,000 votes, seeing that kind of cash porn at the last second is normal, and I'm sure it's difficult to manage. I mean, I'm more concerned with the fact that he was one of the one of our two representatives that voted against removing Confederate statues from our Capitol. So I think that this reporting thing is unfortunate, but there are some other moves that he's making.
Bigger issues.
You know, bigger issues for me, including investigating January 6th.
Dan, feel free to make quick commentary there. If you don't want to say anything, I want to talk about what the Utah Department of Transportation has recommended in Little Cottonwood Canyon. But feel free to, any big deal on Burgess there that you want to comment on?
I am not terribly surprised that anyone running for Congress for the first time has problems with the FEC laws. They're a mess. And, you know, look, the Capitol and the statues have a mixed legacy. I'd like to see more updating of those things and see more states follow Utah's example.
Hmm. Yeah, interesting. Okay, so big news for Little Cottonwood Canyon. Environmental impact statement. Two alternatives were actually selected by UDOT and put forward for comment. One is for enhanced bus service in the canyon, and another is for the gondola. This is really, Shireen and Dan, a competition between reliability, which is what the gondola provides. This is a big avalanche-prone area. And cost, which is the bus service is the cheapest of the two. Shireen, quick comment on Little Cottonwood Canyon and these options. Do you have a favorite?
Yeah, I do. So I would recommend that people go to the UDOT site. You can engage with us. There is incredible imagery and videos that have been put together so you can kind of get a sense of it. And I would encourage people to interact with it. I'm a bus girl. I think bus is the way to go. I think it gives us more opportunities for different kinds of recreation access in that canyon. I think the gondola serves a pretty small slice of individuals coming to that canyon. And I think the bus is better.
Yeah. Dan, they widen the road and they make a bus-only lane. You can stop at more locations, but the gondola is pretty attractive after a powdered, you know, big snowstorm. You can get people up there.
The gondola is the way of the future. And honestly, I would love to close that canyon to vehicular traffic altogether, right? And make it so that, like, it was emergency traffic and we maintain that road for emergency purposes only. Get most of the traffic out of that canyon, if not all of it. And run the gondola, and everybody uses it, and it's part of the ski and convenience pass or whatever it might be. But that gondola system could be super cool for the state.
Shireen, we have about 30 seconds left in the program. I know you wanted to mention the end of Pride Month. Quick commentary on that.
Yeah, so I just wanted to offer a couple thoughts on Pride. We're at the end of the month, and I do think that we continue to hear kind of commentary largely in the public of, you know, do we still need Pride? Why do we need Pride? And there were a number of beautiful events that were organized across the community, and I just want to acknowledge that we live in a time where the Trevor Project estimates that at least one LGBTQ youth between the ages of 13 and 24 attempts suicide every 45 seconds in the United States. Same-sex marriage around the world is only legal in about 15% of the countries. There are many laws that criminalize homosexuality across the world. And here at home, you know, we're seeing attacks on our trans community. So there is a lot that still needs to be done, a lot of understanding and a lot of knowledge that we can share with each other to help make this a more peaceful and welcoming society and a place where queer kids know that they are welcome. So I just wanted to add that at the end, thinking about ways that you can continue to engage, learn, and grow.
Well said, Shireen. I'm Natalie Gochner with Shireen Gorbani, Dan McKay. Programs produced by Anthony Scoma. Hey, thanks everybody for tuning in.